Roger and Thomas, thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this conference. It's been extremely illuminating for me so far, and I think it's a tough act to follow after all these great presentations. I come to this topic from the angle of finance, so you'll have to maybe narrow the focus quite a bit from what you've heard so far. We've heard large-scale issues being discussed, policy issues, and what I will try and discuss is a much smaller scale problem, which is how financial markets can should participate in the climate transition from fossil fuel to renewable energy. So this is a little bit of a technical title. Let me start with something very non-technical, which is as a cartoon from the New Yorker magazine. Here again, I hope I'm not violating any copyrights. But I think this is probably most of your view of where finance is today. And that's probably reflects, I think, a consensus in financial markets. But viewing climate change from the point of view of a more responsible investor, the first thing to note is that there are two reinforcing aspirations for such investors. The first one is, of course, to act in a socially responsible manner. And here I picked a quote. This was from a conference we had at Columbia about a year ago from David Pitt Watson, which I think reflects in many ways, it's a broader point, but I think it reflects the change perspective to addressing climate and also how we approach climate agreements. And the point is that when it comes to climate change, we're all players, we're not spectators. I think that's the important point. It's not just a question of, well, let's hope our governments get it right and set a carbon tax and so on and set the right subsidies. It's a question of everybody participating at every level possible and trying to accelerate the transition. So that's a first aspiration you would have as a responsible investor. But a second aspiration as an investor is that you want to manage risk. You want to manage your risk. And what does that mean? It means you want to identify all the risk factors you're exposed to, and you want to avoid, once you've identified them, you want to avoid the risks that are not adequately rewarded. And the point is that climate change is such a risk factor. Now, there have been, broadly speaking, three approaches in finance to address climate change. You've had the divestment movement, very vocal, very visible on US campuses. And is associated with movements like Carbon Tracker 200, 350.org, etc. You've had the engagement movement. This comes from more like pension funds, institutional investors who are trying to influence the policies of the companies in which they're investing. And here I'm naming three very prominent such institutional investors, NBIM for Norway, CalPERS, and the Church of England. And then the third approach, which I will focus on, is decarbonization of indices, and I will say more about that in a second. I want to flag that all of these three approaches are represented in a coalition that was set up by the UN, so a Portfolio Decarbonization Coalition, and I will say a little bit more at the end of my talk about where that coalition stands. Okay, so climate and carbon risk. So from the point of view of investors, you're facing, if you want, two types of risk when it comes to climate. One is, the risk that at some point carbon emissions will be priced, there will be tougher regulations, there will be a carbon tax and so on, which basically means that the companies that you invested in that relied on carbon not being taxed will start making less money. They will start their profits will be lower, and so you'll be losing financial returns the day when these policies are implemented. That's one obvious risk. Now the second risk that you're facing is that you don't know when these things will happen. Now, of course, we understand that COP21 will introduce a number of commitments by countries to start introducing tougher climate mitigation policies. But you know, we're talking about various horizons. We don't know over that horizon when these things will come on stream and so on. So you're facing substantial timing risk. And it's the difficulty is really how you manage those two risks. Let me mention one important manifestation of a risk that's been emphasized recently a lot that you might be facing, and that is the risk with respect to stranded assets. This is a picture many of you may have seen coming from Carbon Tracker and the Grantham Research. And basically, stranded assets are everything above this line. Okay, and these are all proven reserves. So if you're investing in coal companies, oil companies, natural gas companies, and they tell you, well, you know, our valuation should be this based on our proven reserves and what we can extract from those reserves. Well, you have to take into account that maybe a big part of the proven reserves will stay underground. My sense is that this is probably not controversial at this point. I mean, things are moving pretty fast. But my sense is that coal is definitely a stranded asset at this point. And this is very visible when you look at the stock price of Peabody Energy, which is one of the largest pure play coal companies. If you invested $100 in April 2010 in Peabody, those $100 would now be worth $20. Whereas if you had invested those $100 in the S&P 500, in the market, basically, your $100 today would be worth about $160. So that's if you want a more vivid expression from financial markets about stranded assets, it's hard to beat this picture. Now, what do you do about this risk? Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, one approach. It's highly vocally advocated, is divestment. But what I want to emphasize is that divestment is not necessarily, while it's great from a socially responsible perspective, it's not ideal from a risk management perspective. And just to highlight that point, if you had invested in, the important plot here to track is the red one. That's the S&P 500. And then you see that all these other plots here, they start, after the financial crisis, they start underperforming the S&P. And these are all indices of clean or renewable energy. Okay, so that's the problem with investing, fully divesting from fossil fuels, is that you're taking substantial timing risk with respect to when your investments are going to pay off. So that's one consideration. The other consideration is that while it may be desirable for most of us to divest from fossil fuel, we as individuals represent a very small fraction of the market. A much bigger fraction of the market is represented by asset managers. And asset managers, when you tell them you should divest, they respond, well, it's all fine and good, but you know, we have a fiduciary duty to our clients, and we have to the extent possible, achieve the highest financial returns possible. So from the point of view of asset managers, you know, here's a quote from one of the asset managers on their website saying, but this is something you find in many, you know, many statements. Basically, your divestment is not well suited for asset managers. So this brings me now to decarbonizing indices, which is what we've been pushing. Decarbonizing indices does is it offers you a compromise. It gives you reduced exposure to carbon risk, which is what you're trying to achieve, but it does not come with reduced exposure to other risks you might want to hold because they're well rewarded. That's basically the idea. Now, in technical terms, what that means is that you're maximizing carbon footprint reduction subject to maintaining a minimum tracking error. So the basic logic of the strategy of decarbonizing indices is you're reducing your exposure to an unpriced risk factor, carbon risk, but as I said, you maintain your exposure to all the other risk factors. So from a return perspective, so compensation for holding risk, you're going to achieve the same returns as the benchmark indices, as the market, as long as carbon isn't priced, or as long as carbon isn't expected to be priced. Once those expectations change and investors believe, well, carbon will be priced at some point in the future, your decarbonized index is going to outperform the market. Okay, that's the idea. Now, of course, the underlying premise, I've said that already twice, is that financial markets currently underprice carbon risk. I'm talking to a converted audience. I think you probably all agree with me that's probably the case today. Now, I've had one of my colleagues who immediately pointed out, yeah, if you're going to divest from coal, potential risk you're running is that maybe one day someone will come up with a new carbon sequestration technology which will make suddenly coal very attractive. Yeah, that's a potential risk you're running by divesting from coal, but you know, in probability terms, that's probably a very small risk. So the point is that by holding a decarbonized index, what you're holding effectively is a free option on carbon. So as I said, the decarbonized portfolio replicates market returns until greenhouse gas emissions start being priced or are expected to be priced. And at that point, the decarbonized portfolio starts beating the index. So this is in picture terms, how this will look. Now you'll notice on the left-hand side, the low carbon index already plotted to be above the reference index. So it already looks good, even when in a world where carbon isn't priced yet. Of course, once pricing happens, this gap will just grow bigger. But more on what happens on the left-hand side in a couple of slides. So how does this work in practice? Well, you have the index providers, MSCI, FTSE, S&P 500, S&P, Dow Jones, okay? On the one hand, so they provide indices, more than the well-known ones that we know. And then you have the carbon data providers, Truecost, CDP, and others, South Pole and so on. And you can rely on the carbon data to exclude high carbon stocks and either exclude or underweight high carbon stocks. Okay? So that's the first step. That's how you decarbonize the index. You take out or you go underweight high carbon stocks. Now, let me give you an example of an index, a low carbon index that MSCI has introduced just a little under a year ago, last November, and that we have worked with, and how that works. Okay, so MSCI Europe over this period, so about less than a year, had a return of about 11%, 11.1%. And the MSCI Europe Low Carbon Leaders Index over this period had an 11.7% return. So what's the difference between these two indices? Well, you're excluding 20% of the so-called highest emitters, but you're trying to preserve sectoral balance. That's an important consideration. I will return to that again in a second. And you're also excluding owners of large potential stranded assets. What you can do is you exclude those 20%. That's the first step. Then you're left with fewer firms in your index. Second step is you reweight the decarbonized index with the goal of minimizing tracking error with the reference index. So you can achieve, when you do that, you can achieve about 0.7 tracking error. This is very small. This is in this industry, people acknowledge it's a very small tracking error. And while by maintaining such a low tracking error, you're getting a reduced exposure to carbon of 62% and to stranded assets of 81%. Okay. And so here's the plot. So this is some of it is based on backtesting. As I said to you, the index was introduced in November 14th. So you want to start looking from here. And this is based on backtesting. But basically, from November 14 to this goes to March 15. This has become even bigger. The outperformance of the low carbon index has been 197 basis points, which is substantial. So there are a few things you might worry about in taking such an approach. Here I'm just mentioning three considerations that are potentially important. One is maintaining sector composition. You might say, well, the only effective way of decarbonizing is to go short the entire fossil fuel energy sector. Well, that's not quite true because greenhouse gas emissions are also attributable to other sectors than the energy sector, fossil fuel energy sector, mining, construction, transport, and so on. So you can go underweight those sectors. You don't have to go entirely underweight the energy sector. That's the first issue you might have in mind. Second issue is size of companies. Of course, the bigger the company, the bigger the carbon footprint, other things equal. Now, you wouldn't want to exclude big companies just because they have a high carbon footprint, because those companies, although they have a high carbon footprint, they are very efficient. You want to somehow scale the carbon emissions by sales or employment or other measures or a kilometer distance if you're looking at transport, etc. So that's a second consideration which you can take into account in your the way you construct a decarbonized portfolio. And then you also want to take into account whether companies are actually proactive in reducing their carbon emissions. You don't necessarily want to throw out companies that have high carbon emissions today, but are investing a lot in reducing those carbon emissions. You might want to maintain those in your index. Just to give you a sense of what we're talking about, so of course we've heard a lot yesterday and most of today, we've heard a lot about countries and countries having to reduce their economies' carbon emissions, but you can also look at everything through the lens of companies. And you know, just to give you a sense of what that does, well, global 500 largest companies in the world, they represent 28% of world GDP, which is GDP of US and Japan combined. So if you start intervening at the level of these large companies, you may be able to have you know, eventually similar scaled impact as engaging with the governments of the largest economies, countries with the largest economies. Now, from the point of view of Global 500, it's not so great. So, greenhouse gas emissions have increased over this period. And the other point I should mention is that emissions, this is a big gap in current data available to be able to implement this kind of policy, is emissions that get measured are so-called Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. But Scope 3, which is important, is typically not measured, and so that's a serious limitation to this approach. And you might want to, you know, obviously the way to go in the future is to encourage the data providers to come up with methodologies for accounting for Scope 3 emissions. So this is you know, let me turn now to implications for public policy. And before I say how this is a complement to some of the policies we've heard discussed so far, I want to emphasize this strategy, holding decarbonized indices. This strategy stands on its own. You don't have to even ask, well, do I need to bring in the public sector? Does it only make sense if certain policies get put in place? You can be completely agnostic, first of all, on how concerned you are about climate change, and completely agnostic on your skepticism. We've heard some pessimistic views and some optimistic views on how effective climate mitigation policies will be post-Paris. You can basically, even if you're a skeptic, you should invest just from the point of view of financial interest, you should invest in decarbonized indices, because the evidence is, so first of all, they're constructed to replicate the market if nothing happens, and they're constructed to beat the market if something happens. Okay, so this is a policy, if you want, of doing well while doing good. And you can be a climate skeptic, you will still come out well on the financial side. That's important because this is a strategy that can be scaled massively, because it's well suited for institutional investors. I'll give you some numbers in the last slide. So you know, that's almost like a punchline. I could stop here. You should, you know, university endowments, to the extent that they are index investors, should adopt this strategy. Pension funds, any asset manager around the world should adopt this strategy. There's no downside. Now, having said this, there is some positive reinforcement aspects to this strategy with public policy. Okay, so I really see this as a complement to what the governments are trying to do. And it's a complement because it gives stronger incentives to the largest corporations in the world to invest in greenhouse gas emission reductions. And let me emphasize here again important aspect of why this is a useful complement. So as I said, the decarbonized index will start outperforming the market index, the market, the minute investors' expectations about climate mitigation policies coming on stream in the future change. So we've heard a lot about commitments, no more carbon emissions by 2030 and so on. Now, if those commitments are credible, it's not like we're going to benefit from those commitments in 2030. Through these decarbonized indices, we're going to benefit today because expectations are going to bring the effect of those policies forward through financial markets. And so there's going to be immediate pressure. And what's an added attraction is we heard one presentation yesterday that, well, it's easy to make commitments, it's much harder to honor them. Well, in a way, if you have this complementary strategy from financial markets, in a way, all you need to do is fool investors that they will happen. So even if they're not really credible, as long as investors believe these commitments are credible, you're going to have real effects. And so that's the, if you want, the attraction of this approach. Other points to say about public policy is that in the game of finding new ways of showing you're committed to climate mitigation policies, in making your commitments visible in Paris. Here's a commitment you any country can make for free, which is to say we're going to pass a law to mandate disclosure of carbon footprints for all asset managers. Now, France has passed such a law, I'll show you in a second, and a number of asset managers and asset owners have already started, here's a list, have already started disclosing their carbon footprint of their portfolio. So here's the text of the French law. It's in too small print for you to see, but it's part of the commitments that France is taking in COP21. And what it says, if you want, in short, is that carbon footprint disclosure will almost, I put in brackets, be mandatory for all asset owners. The almost is just that the text is a little vague and the décret d'application is not yet written. But it's coming on stream and then we'll know better. So that's another useful, complementary role that policy can play in supporting these strategies. I promised a word about the Portfolio Decarbonization Coalition that I mentioned earlier. Okay, so this is something that is being put together under the auspices of the United Nations. And this is less than a year old. Notice commitments to decarbonize of the members. So these are the members here. Have already reached 62 billion so far. But these institutions are ramping up their commitment over time. And just to give you a sense of how far they can go, they have combined, they have assets under management of 1.2 trillion. And of course, other asset owners are welcome to join. So to conclude, I would like to offer this quote from Robert Shiller. He writes in his latest book, "Finance is not about making money per se," as it's often portrayed that way or believed to be that way, but it's not about making money per se. It's a functional science in that it exists to support other goals, those of society. The better aligned society's financial institutions are with its goals and ideals, the stronger and more successful the society will be. So this is very much in the spirit of this quote that we have undertaken this developed this policy and undertaken the gone down this path. And the point is, of course, climate scientists have been very active in this area. Economists have been active, but finance has been relatively silent. And we're trying. You know, this is one way of trying to bring in the finance community into climate change issues.